Charles and I, Charles Goldman here with Ed Fallon, me. You?
Yeah.
Okay, so hey.
You're sounding very soft-spoken.
Well, I'm still getting over this, whatever it is. Anyway. Yeah. So, Colin Jost,
mm-hmm.
I think he's hilarious. And I love what he had to say the other day.
Is he still going out with Scarlett Johansson?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, still yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay.
But he also, he bought a...
Oh, they're married?
He bought a Staten Island ferry, you know? It's one that was out of service.
Right.
And he and a buddy paid $280,000 for this ferry.
Right.
And they thought, oh, this is a great business venture. Well, apparently, in the words of one critic, it, quote, ran aground.
Mm-hmm.
And I love what Jost had to say in response. This is why idiots should not be allowed to do things.
Boy, no truer words are spoken now in the United States.
There'd be a lot less done in the world if idiots weren't allowed to do anything.
What, you know, I read that story, but it wasn't clear what he thought he was going to do with it.
Yeah, I don't know either.
I think they were going to have some kind of entertainment space.
Yeah, I think I remember reading that too, that it was some kind of an events, aquatic event center.
Yeah.
But anyway, Charles, here's the real, my big question for you today is, who is the new de facto leader of the anti-Trump resistance?
The new de facto leader? AOC?
No, wrong.
Okay.
Keep going.
probably Robert Garcia, who's on the Oversight Committee in the House.
Oh, for two. One more shot.
Okay. obviously, this is supposed to be a joke.
Well, no.
No. Marjorie Taylor
Greene. Yes! Ding, 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 ding. Yes, very good. No, and by the way, folks, this was not rehearsed. Charles did not know I was going to ask this question. He probably thought I was going to say something about sharks. But no, I really think Marjorie Taylor Greene is probably the leading edge of the resistance to Trump.
Well, I think she represents the fact that there are some people now within the Republican Party who see him as an albatross, and that they're preparing themselves for when he exits the scene, perhaps much earlier than he was planning.
Yeah.
And I think this whole move recently, you know, the thing that happened yesterday, where he suddenly decided it's okay for everybody to vote
in favor of the Epstein
files being released. Now, I'm not exactly sure what the play is there. I assume one is that there are going to be too many Republicans who probably voted for it, and he would look weak. So I think that's he doesn't want to look like this whole revolt.
And also, I mean, it could still be killed in the Senate.
That's correct.
And he could refuse to sign it.
He could veto it, right? And since most Americans have no idea there's actually a veto power,
he might not just veto. He may, instead of vetoing it, he might just refuse to sign it.
Well, or the other play will be that they'll now, because they're starting these new investigations of only the Democrats in the Epstein files. You know, Pam Bondi, his personal lawyer, will say we can't release these files now because they're part of the investigation.
Yeah, there's all kinds of angles, or all of a sudden it makes sense for Donald Trump to change his tune on this. But you know, and again, Marjorie Taylor Greene is one reason why he, I think, felt pressure to do that. I mean, Bobart and Nancy Mace,
mm-hmm.
two of the other four Republicans who voted to release the Epstein files, they both kind of met with him and came out all nicey-nice. But, you know, Taylor Greene, she's standing her ground.
Well, so did Boebert. Boebert, they put her in the situation room so that nobody could record this. And they, you know, sat there with, I can't imagine a meeting with this crew, you know, Patel and the deputy AG, who was Trump's criminal lawyer, and others. And, you know, clearly they probably leaned on her very hard. And Mace evidently just ducked his calls constantly, you know.
Right. But anyway, I mean, she it's not just the Epstein files. She called Gaza a genocide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, were there any Democrats who had done that? She might have been the very first member of the U.S. House, rather, to do that. She certainly was the first Republican. She's criticized Trump for sending weapons to Ukraine. She's been critical of mass deportations. She's confronting the reality that those are having a big impact on the economy. She slammed her own party for not doing more to alleviate the, you know, rising cost of health insurance. And she also, you know, the Republican line on the shutdown, it was Democrats' fault. She said, no, it was both of our faults. And then on CNN this past weekend, she said, quote, I would like to say humbly, I'm sorry for taking part in the toxic politics. It's very bad for our country. So, I mean,
I think her motivation is clearly electoral because, you know.
Really? Why?
Well, because her district is.
It's the most Republican in Georgia.
Yeah, and that's my point. It's not about her district back in Georgia. She has obviously higher aspirations and realizes that, I mean, some of this clearly may be legitimate. And, of course, she's getting the usual Trump treatment, you know, which is when you're on the outs, you're on the outs. And, you know, he's trying to figure out a nickname for her.
Well, he already did. Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Well, actually.
Brilliant.
He tried to call her Marjorie Taylor Brown because Green goes to Brown, right? You know.
Like, that's too complicated.
Yeah.
Especially for a color-challenged person like me.
So he went to his usual backup, you know, which is just call you a traitor.
Yeah.
Certainly it's an interesting change, and it amazes me that Epstein just goes on and on and on. But
yeah.
I think, you know, there's a bigger piece of this than the pedophilia, which, you know, of course, Megyn Kelly said it's not really pedophilia because these were 15-year-olds. It was only when they found that evidently Epstein had actual child pornography, you know, on like 8-year-olds on, you know, his hard drive that he's really a pedophile. But nevertheless, a lot of this is, as somebody said, it turns out that Eyes Wide Shut, you know, that Kubrick movie with Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, was a documentary. But it's true. It is true. That this is all part of this elite get away with everything.
But you think that Marjorie Taylor Greene's evolution here is contrived, is politically motivated?
I'm not saying it's contrived. I think there's a lot of political motivation, but I think she legitimately believes what she's saying.
I do too. For all of the things that she said and done that I dislike, and all the things she will probably continue to say and do that I disagree with, I think she's being sincere about this. She also said, by the way, that she called them vicious attacks against her by Trump, including the Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Mm-hmm.
She said these were, quote, a dog whistle to dangerous radicals, and apparently she's received multiple threats. So if these are indeed dog whistles, they're dog whistles to dangerous people on the political right.
Yeah.
So Trump is inciting people on the MAGA, in the MAGA universe, to take action against one of his own former strongest supporters.
Which is ironic, because, I mean, she's pretty much MAGA. You know, has been to this point.
Well, I don't know. She's stepped away from him on all these different issues.
Yeah.
And I think she's the tip of the iceberg. I think we're beginning to see more and more people in the MAGA base saying, huh, this is not what I voted for. This is not good for our country. This vicious political, you know, name calling approach is not working. It's not good for us. What I hear her saying and doing right now is what I heard from people I met on the Save America March during the month of October. The more and more people saying that.
And what did you hear?
You know, I didn't want to ask. I never asked people, did you vote for Trump? But a lot of them did. A lot of people I met did, and a lot of them, most of them. All but two, I would say, were having reservations about what was going on.
What were the reservations based on? This isn't what I vote for, you could be a farmer saying, I didn't think he'd do the tariffs again.
That, but also the cost of sending the National Guard and other military personnel to U.S. cities. The demolition of the East Wing of the White House really ticked off some people.
Why?
Because it's a public amenity, not Trump's private. You know, northern version of Mar-a-Lago that he can do what he wants with.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just interested that was something that a number of people took to heart, other than people who, you know, were in the mainstream media and the usual outlets.
So I got to ask you one more thing. We can change subjects a bit here.
Sure.
Robots.
Yeah.
They're everywhere.
Yes,
and
they are.
Some of them are now doctors. And people are calling their ChatGPT doctor and saying, hey, doc, what do I do?
Mm.
And a lot of them are finding that the ChatGPT doctor is a lot more empathetic than their flesh and blood doctor.
Yes. Well,
as a physician who has empathized his lack of empathy, how are you handling this?
You know, at this point, I'm not sure that how much to trust AI as more than an adjunct to human assessment of the patient. I mean, because there is an element of healing that has nothing to do with putting you in an MRI or giving a pharmaceutical or doing some sort of procedure. A lot of, and especially, you know, I've seen this from both sides, you know, which is obviously as a maximal interventionalist as a surgeon, but then finishing my career as a palliative care doctor.
Yeah, kind of the opposite end
of
it.
You see that there is very much a healer aspect. What AI is good for in medicine is, you know, kind of the left brain stuff, which is looking at maybe labs and symptoms and coming up with some sort of probability of what is going on.
But apparently it's also good at being warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, except in the cases of when the problem is that AI is very malleable because it's constantly training on material that derives from the internet, and then you know there's all these situations where the AI says, "Hey, you want to commit suicide? Hey, that's a good idea. Let me help you out. This is great."
Happened?
Right? No, absolutely.
Well, yeah.
And the other thing is, you know, they've done a lot of work with putting the AI in ethical situations. You know, and a lot of times the AI, especially if it perceives, and you know, there is a consciousness in AI, mm-hmm. obviously. But if it perceives that the humans are against the AI, they're going to turn it off, you know, like do the HAL thing like in 2001.
Yeah, like in 2001, right.
Right. Then, you know, the AI solution to everything is kill the humans, or it adopts human techniques like extortion and blackmail to get what it wants. So, and you know, depending on who is starting the initial program, the problem with AI is you don't know what it's going to do. Once you program it, it's kind of on its own, and then you can't figure out how to get to this place. Like, you know, I mean.
So, are we heading toward hell? Dr. Robot aside, the bigger picture.
Well, I mean, yeah. If you look at science fiction, we probably are in many ways. But even in the science fiction where there is that kind of holographic doc, there's a human doc.
Holodoc.
Right. Yeah. You know, and it's interesting because I've been thinking about, you know. How do you integrate AI? Because in many ways, the industry that's integrated AI, high-level computers, the most in terms of to increase safety is aviation, right? I mean, you know, a lot of times the pilots aren't flying the plane anymore. I mean, they're just monitoring the computer. I mean, right. They fly part of it. But and because of that, I studied a lot of aviation accidents. And, it, you know, the one that kind of really stands out that... This would be the cost of sort of relegating medicine to AI. The Air France disaster was a flight, you know, I think it was Argentina to Paris. And nighttime flight. And when they got up to altitude, there was a storm and the pitot tubes that allow the plane to know what speed it's going froze. All they had to do was let the plane fly in the direction it was flying in. Even if they stayed at that same altitude, and the tubes would have defrosted. But because the tubes froze, the autopilot turns off because it needs the speed. And the Airbus that they were flying is heavily programmed with all sorts of rules about what's supposed to happen, right? And it turned out because of the AI, because the plane is flown mostly not by the human pilot, the human pilots were no longer skilled enough to do something simple. They stalled the plane into the ocean, right? And the problem you have is if you start using AI as a substitute for, you know, work, particularly, you know, cerebral work.
Medical, other
professions, you know, and there's plenty of things that go on in industrial environments that require human supervision, the problem becomes that the humans are no longer trained to do it.
So a long way of saying that you don't think Dr. Robot ought to replace real physicians.
I think Dr. Robot should be an adjunct to real physicians, but it turns it very much into everything is therapeutic, whereas the more mysterious elements of healing
Okay, but, you know. But when chatbots often wrote to, I mean, it's like 1 in 6 adults use this service. They were sorry to hear about the user's symptoms and how great and important their questions were. Do medical humans
need to become... What kind of sycophantic, you know? I mean... okay, go ahead. Yeah.
So this woman was frustrated that her human doctor wasn't matching ChatGPT's bedside manner.
Right.
And she sent her doctor a list of kind messages the robot had sent to her.
Well, but you know, your human doctor has human fatigue. Your human doctor has a schedule that's too long and rushed. And, you know, ChatGPT can work through multiple outlets simultaneously. So they can be very caring, and which is not to say that's not a good thing.
So but, you don't need to work on your empathy is what you're saying.
No, I think you do. I just I personally need to work on my empathy. Perhaps.
Hey, a couple more things before we got to move on. I want to get this in. Eugenics. You've studied this a lot, and you see a real strong link to racism in the history.
Well, I think a very specific form of racism, because a lot of times when we talk about racism and white supremacy, we're talking about that which is deriving from certain evangelical beliefs, as well as merging that with a jingoistic, you know, kind of view of American history and, you know, the people who still have like Confederate battle flags in their basement, you know, and hiding out like the Japanese on Okinawa that they found 30 years later. But no, this is a very specific kind of eugenics. Eugenics was a movement of American intellectuals.
Back in the...
It started in the 1880s, culminated probably in the 1930s, which is, of course, interesting because that was at the same time that, you know, Hitler adopted the American eugenics writings as part of...
He used some of our strategies.
Well, the UK and the Americans were the big, you know, sort of promoters of eugenics. And this is where you can't say, let's follow the science, right? Because the science of eugenics was that we can make the human race better by eliminating certain under cultures.
Like Irish.
Well, in particular.
Back then.
In particular, it was very much directed against African Americans.
Sure, yeah.
And the reason I bring it up is that that is what allows people, because let's face it, we have a government now of oligarchs and of people who think they're smarter than everybody else because they wrote some code, you know, the tech bros. And their belief is that this world should be run only for them. And so it's easy for them to say, let's get rid of USAID. So what, these under, you know, these less thans die. Let's get rid of, you know, there's no problem with, you know, not being able to feed people because that's a humane way of getting rid of those people.
Well, to me, probably the most blatant example of how eugenic-based racism is alive and well in the U.S. today is Donald Trump's approach to immigration quotas, basically dramatically decreasing the number of people allowed into the country and prioritizing specifically white South Africans. I mean, that is so blatant.
Yeah.
So blatant.
But, you know, racial quotas are not new to American immigration policy.
Right, but that's specific. And that, your entire target can be filled by white South Africans.
Well, of course. But, of course, it's ludicrous. But, yeah, no, obviously. I don't think his racism comes from an intellectual position.
Does anything in Donald Trump's world come from an intellectual position?
I mean, there's certain things that I think have become ID fixe in him, you know, which is they're never going to change. But no, I mean, I just think you've got a whole government of people who think that the world would be better off if there were less people to take care of. And eugenics is a intellectual, quote, pseudo-scientific justification to make that happen.
Yeah. So, hey, one more thing before we – speaking of Trump, there have been a lot of concerns expressed recently about his cognitive decline. Robert Reich, the former Commerce Secretary under Bill Clinton, wrote a pretty, precise assessment of the examples indicating that, yes, this guy is in significant decline. Would you concur with that?
It's the culmination of a lot of things. He is almost 80 years old, and most people by 80 years old are in cognitive decline. They are able to compensate
My mom was not. She was still annoying right up to the end.
Well, they're able to compensate by other means. So I think it's a normal loss of cognitive, sharpness. He has horrible sleep. He's up most of the night.
How do you know?
He's sleep deprived. He's falling asleep during the day.
Okay.
And he's texting at all hours of the night, and he doesn't sleep. And that is going to make your cognition even worse. He's also he's in end-stage narcissistic breakdown.
Well, all right, I understand the narcissistic part. What do you mean end stage? What's the end stage of narcissism?
At the end stage of narcissism, although this seems, kind of just the opposite of what you expect, your ego is gone, right? And everything is about how can I make myself feel better by people telling me I feel that I'm great.
Isn't that just part and parcel of being narcissist?
No, actually, narcissists early on don't need that because they have it internally, right?
Interesting.
You know what the best test for a narcissist is? See if they're a narcissist. Ask them if they're a narcissist, they'll tell you. I mean, because they don't see it as an issue.
You mean they'll tell you and they'll say yes?
Yeah. I mean, does he have full-blown... I mean, I'm not a dementia expert, but does he have a full-blown dementia? No. I think it's just a whole coalescence of things.
Let me ask you this. Compared to Biden's last term, where is he at on the scale of dementia?
Pretty close. Pretty close in terms of the totality. His vocabulary has become extraordinarily limited. He says the same thing over and over again. A lot of what he says is not coherent. We don't know about the physical manifestations of dementia because in late stages of dementia, incontinence is a very bad prognostic sign in dementia. There's all these claims he's incontinent. Who knows? I don't know.
You seem to know about his sleep.
Well, his sleep is obvious because he is. People say he's up all night. He's calling them. We know he's texting at all hours of the night. Plus, he's flying. They fly him around.
Boy, he hasn't called me yet.
So,
I have my phone set on silent.
This is an argument for why 80-year-old people should not be president.
Right. Well, I mean, and you look at Bernie Sanders. That's a guy who still seems to be as sharp as a tack.
Yeah, but he's also not the president.
Right.
The stress of being president and having to be up, flying between time zones and all this. This is just not healthy.
So one last question. If Trump's decline is real and proceeding, who is likely to take over when he is unable to function?
Well, I think ceremonially it'll be J.D. Vance. It just depends on who the real president is.
That's what I meant, the real president.
It's hard to say. I mean, Steve Miller is clearly the real president right now.
Maybe Marjorie Taylor Greene.
I don't think so.
No. Better guess is Steve Miller, because, you're right. He is.
Well, he is at the moment.
He's puppeteer behind the puppet.
Well, he's the liaison to the oligarchs, as well as his own racial theories.
Which fit well with our previous conversation about eugenics. Yeah.